I'm not sure I want to follow that, but but it's really, really great to be back again. It's been some time since I've been here, and I'm beginning to reconnect with some faces that I've seen many, many times. And I hope we have a chance to maybe talk about some of the issues a little bit later that we're going to talk about here. I will be doing a four-part series on, on the kerygma and the historical Jesus. And this is an area of exploration of the historical Jesus, not the kerygma Jesus. The kerygma Jesus we talked about earlier and we shared in the Apostles' Creed, which was not only shared here, but also earlier in the 9:30 service and consistently throughout the life of our church, not only here, but throughout Christendom as a whole on the many continents of our globe. The historical Jesus is a different approach to understanding who Jesus was. And the historical Jesus is an attempt to make a connection, so to speak, between the kerygmatic Jesus, or Christ of faith, and who the real historical Jesus was. And one of the questions that we will raise and talk about throughout this series is how much overlap is there between the scholarly study of the historical Jesus, number one, and then later what the church thought of him. And there are some scholars who think there's not very much overlap at all, that the historical Jesus was a very different human being from the Christ of faith that emerged out of the theological convictions that surrounded him. And our goal here is to try to explore what the various historical Jesus scholars think of him, and in the end, ask this question: did the church get him right? That is the church an extension of the historical Jesus? And does the church, and has the church historically, and does it continue to build on what Jesus thought of himself? That's really the issue. Now, to start out with, I should say there are a group of people out there called the mythicists. That's a, what does that mean? It means that there are many people who study Jesus think that much of what's written or said about him in the Bible and in the creeds of the church is, to use a pejorative phrase which I don't like, made up. And it's hard to find the real historical Jesus underneath the church's affirmation of him as the Christ of faith. That's what we're going to examine. So what you have here, the kerygma, for example, and if you turn to the screen, you will see when we say the Apostles' Creed is that Jesus is defined as, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, and in Jesus, who is conceived by the Holy Spirit, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, and so on, rose from the dead and sits at the right hand of God the Father. I believe in the resurrection of the body. All right? Now, the second part of this is the kerygma, science, and higher criticism. According to our knowledge of the natural laws, the natural world, as it's been explored and elaborated and discovered over the last 200 years of modern science, there are many aspects of the kerygma, as well as the biblical miracles, that appear to be physically impossible. How do we reconcile these theological beliefs with contradictory scientific findings? Applying the methods of modern science to the study of the creeds and the Bible in order to answer these questions is called higher criticism. And any of you who have a theological background or have had the good fortune to go to seminary will recognize that historical criticism has been with us for a while. It's an attempt to apply what we understand about the nature of truth in our modern scientific world to a perception, a theological set of beliefs that emerged at another time in our ancient world. That's the challenge that's right there. And higher criticism has been about that task for some time. Now, what I'm going to try to do today is lay out the issues. I'm going to lay out the issues, and then the next three sessions, I'm going to proceed through the historical Jesus research to identify how scholars think about the connection between the historical Jesus and the Jesus of our kerygma. That's the plan. So today is a kind of a table setting experience, and what we do in the next three sessions will fill up the table, so to speak, with lots, I hope, of good things to eat, all right? Although sometimes some people enter into the study of the historical Jesus and get very nervous when they hear things that are not necessarily consistent with the kerygma Jesus of the church or that they were raised with their entire lives. And my view is that I believe the study of the historical Jesus deepens our faith. That's my perspective. It deepens our faith, although for some people it can be very challenging and very threatening. And why this is so will become clear hopefully in this session, but certainly by the end of the fourth session. And not everybody agrees. To me, the study of the historical Jesus is a little bit like different interpretations of who Jesus was during the first and second generation after he lived. There were many, many interpretations of who he was that range all the way from Paul's kind of incarnational view that shows up in Romans to the group called the Ebionites, who emphasized Jesus was only human and not divine. And then there were souls who emphasized that Jesus was only divine and his humanity was an illusion. It wasn't real. They are frequently called the Docetics and so on. So what we have today is a plethora of interpretations from a historical perspective of who Jesus was in a way that mirrors, if you think of it, what the early church struggled with in terms of trying to identify who he really was. So that's a nice parallel. And what we understand to be Orthodox Christianity does not really emerge until 325 with the Council of Nicaea, which Constantine called together. Up until that time, there was an enormous amount of debate within the church over who Jesus was. We now have a same kind of recurrence, but this time based upon discoveries of modern science relative to the kerygmatic Jesus and the historical Jesus. And that's the difference. The difference is we have a different set of methodologies to apply to understanding who the real Jesus was and how the church came to understand him. All right, now higher criticism is really the result of the impact of the Enlightenment. It's an outgrowth of the methods are called rational, empirical, scientific methods for arriving at the nature of truth. In biblical and creedal studies, higher criticism methods have been used since the end of the 18th century. For example, we used to think, for example, if you got a cold, it might be the result of some secret sins that you were hiding. Well, that still may be the truth, but most of us don't. I don't want to explore that really with anybody. But most of us think now it really comes from the germs, either bacterial or viral or whatever. It's a different perspective. And that is the way in which we approach now the study of the historical Jesus, through rational, empirical methods of discovery to try to arrive at the truth of who he really was historically. Now, it's important that we also keep in mind that there are actually three levels going on here. The first is the Jesus of the kerygma. The second is the historical Jesus. And then there is the real Jesus. Okay? The historical Jesus is a scholarly reconstruction of who Jesus was based upon the four Gospels, maybe five Gospels primarily. And we'll get into those issues a little bit later. The only source we have, historical source, about Jesus himself comes from the Gospels. The four Gospels, and some say the Gospel of Thomas, which I'll talk about a little bit later as well. Those are the sources. There are many sources that identify that Jesus as a real person existed and that the church began to emerge. And there are Roman sources and Jewish sources and so on. But the actual historical sources of who he was come in the Gospels, especially the four Gospels and the Gospel of Thomas. And that's really, really important to remember, is that because Jesus' ministry was very short. It could have lasted 1 year, it could have lasted three. We really don't know. And he had a small gathering. of 12 disciples and some who followed the 12 disciples and were part of his circle. And yet he came and went very, very quickly, wrote nothing down. And one of the issues is, why didn't he write anything down? And we'll talk about that too. Did he think the world was going to come to an end in his generation? Or didn't he think it was worth it? Or he just didn't have time to do it? And so on. And the first gospel, the oldest of the gospels, which scholars generally believe is the gospel of Mark, comes about 30 years after he died. And the oldest writings that we have in the New Testament come from Paul. They do not come from the Gospels. The Gospels emerged after the first generation began to pass away, and many began to ask, who is this Jesus and why hasn't he come back to join us? So that generally tends to be the origin. And Paul did not know the historical Jesus, and he's not interested in the historical Jesus. Paul is interested in the mission of Jesus and what he means for the life of the faith, the early life of the faith. And that's really important to keep in mind. And Paul did not know him, and he did not have his Damascus Road experience, or his conversion, by the way, which is one of the great conversions in the history of the world, until sometime after Jesus' life. So the Gospels get written on the basis of remembered events associated and traditions associated with who Jesus really was. That's really important. And the Gospels are an assembling of different traditions that grew up around him. That's the way to think about it. And in the process of 30 years or so, you know, it's sort of like a big circle of people, and you whisper in someone's ear something, and you ask them to whisper it all the way around until you get to the end. Guess what? It's different, or it's changed, or it's modified, or it's extended, or it's amplified in some way. That's the way in which scholars generally tend to think how the life of Jesus developed and how the Gospels began to develop. And even the so-called authors of the Gospels were not assigned their title until the second century. They were really written anonymously in different locations, which are debated about where it originated, around that particular area, whether it was in the Palestine region, or whether it was in Asia Minor, or whether it was in Europe. So even the origins of some of these are not really well known and highly debated, and the gospel is not by Mark, it's the gospel according to Mark. And Mark, as the author's name, was not assigned till later, and most scholars will accept that. And the names that are assigned to the gospels are generally people who were well known during the first generation. And the closer you get to the life of Jesus, the more credibility the name has in terms of whether the gospel has some authenticity to it, is the way to think of it. So, Mark, traveling companion of Peter, supposedly consists of Peter's sermons. Matthew, the tax collector. What? Luke, who was a traveling companion of Paul. And John, the beloved disciple. All of those people somehow were on the know in the early generation. So, what we have is the Gospels as the primary source to understanding who he was. Now, item number four up here consists of the criteria that scholars use. The first one is multiple attestations. That just means the more it shows up, the more it's believable. The more something is repeated in different contexts, the more credibility it has. The doctrine of dissimilarity is very important, because if Jesus were identical to his times, he would not have created problems that led to his death. So dissimilarity is really also very, very important. The more dissimilar Jesus was, the more his sayings generally tend to be remembered. Memorable forms like the parables. When you say the parable of the sowers, or the parable of the hidden treasure, or the parable of the talents, or the 39, there are actually 39 parables out there. Some of them are assigned to Jesus, and some of them reflect who his personality, his temperament was. Now, the other one is credibility. Did it have credibility? When Jesus identified himself as the Messiah, which he did, he had some sense of the Messiahship about himself. What kind of Messiah he was is still debated among scholars. But it was not, unbelievable for Peter to say, we think you are the Messiah. And everybody says, yeah, you're the Messiah. And Jesus probably thought he was some kind of Messiah himself. It was not unusual, because during that particular context, the Jews were expecting some kind of a Messiah to come and liberate them from the Romans or to transform the world in some way to bring them out of the bondage that they were experiencing under the rulership of Rome. So that's entirely credible. That is, the Messiah concept is entirely credible. Then also you have coherence. It fit. Does it fit into the culture? And the answer is, any particular aspect of Jesus' ministry of going from the Galilean area, which is frequently just referred to as the Galilee, down to Jerusalem for Passover, was credible. It's coherent and it fits into the times. So these are the criteria that scholars use to try to identify who the historical Jesus really was. Now, there are two challenges that we're going to look at very carefully in the next 3 weeks. The first is, there are about 200 Jesus historical scholars in the world. 200, that's a really small group of people, actually. Now, is to identify as accurately as possible the differences and similarities that exist between the historical Jesus and how he's portrayed in the Bible and the creeds. And there's a lot of disagreement on this, all right? Most of the people who are part of that group of 200 are faithful Christians. They're in the church. There are some who are not. There are some who study Jesus just as a historical figure, but they don't have the faith that the other followers have as being in the community that he founded. But most of them are. So we're not talking about just a singular group of atheists, an exclusive group of atheists who have it out for the church, you know, who are angry and who want to make the negative case. There are a lot of Christian scholars in there that are doing some very serious scholarship, and that doesn't always agree with the church's understanding of who Jesus was, but they are very loyal and faithful members of his community. So, similarities and differences, which we're going to talk about. The second challenge is to identify the process by which the church transformed the historical Jesus into the Christ of faith. There's a new book out by been out a while by Bart Ehrman called How the Jesus of History Became the Christ of Faith. And that is a hot topic right now in biblical studies. Bart Ehrman started out at Wheaton College in Illinois, which is a very conservative, literalist college. And by the end, he ended up being an atheist because he can't handle the problem of evil. Why would a good God allow for so much evil to exist? So this is the direction which it goes, but most of the scholars like John Crossman, I'll talk some of these names later, are very faithful, loyal to members of the church. One of the best scholars, known as John Meyer, is a priest who works at Notre Dame University, a good Catholic, whose Jesus ends up looking very Catholic. This should not surprise us. In fact, there are a lot of Jesus scholars who say that the portrait of Jesus that any scholar develops is as much autobiographical as it is biographical. And there is a lot of truth in that. We discover the Jesus we want to see in there, and that's the Jesus we go with. And to me, that's let a thousand flowers bloom. You know, Christ comes to all of us in very different ways, and not just one single way. So having that diversity in the midst of the scholarship community is rich for us to embrace in the same way that the diversity that exists during the early, 50 years of the church was also fun to read, if you liked it, as they say, do that kind of thing, okay? That's the way to do it. So the second challenge is the process by which this transformation occurs. Now, the quest for the historical Jesus, that phrase, the quest for historical Jesus, comes from a book by Albert Schweitzer, which I'll talk about shortly. So when we look for and search for the historical Jesus, we are engaged in a quest for the historical Jesus, or a search. But that's the language. And there are three phases. There's the first quest, the second quest, and the third quest, which we are right in the middle of. Today I'm just going to lay out some of the issues that were discussed in the first quest. Next week I'm going to talk about and summarize some of the ideas of the second quest, and I'm going to take the last two sessions to talk about the third quest, because there's really creative stuff going on out there right now. And once we get into the fourth session, we'll, as they say, try to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, is the way to think of it. We're going to try to find the connections and see what we can do in gathering these various interpretations of who Jesus was, and then apply that to how do we in the church appropriate that in a way that strengthens or deepens our faith. So that's the goal. All right, first quest lasted 128 years. That's a long time. It started in 1778, went to 1906, which is the day in which the year in which Schweitzer wrote The Quest for the Historical Jesus. The second quest was from 1953 to 83, and the third quest, and that lasts 30 years, and the third quest is from 83 until now, or 34 years. And during these quests, scholars use different approaches and develop various views of the historical Jesus. Now, what I'm going to try to do is, it's not the quest, the historical process by which our understanding of Jesus unfolds, that's important, but what's really important is the thematic aspects of how scholars in each of these three quests began to think about the historical Jesus. So I'm going to try to weave these three quests and the thematic materials together so that by the end, the table that is now somewhat empty is filled up and we'll be able to dine from it in some sense and have a good meal as a result of it. Pardon the metaphor. I don't always get them right, but I'm working at it. All right. So let's go to the first quest. I'm going to spend the rest of the time, maybe 15, 20 minutes on the first quest. And then I'm going to open it up for questions that you might have as we've done in the past. Okay. So give us a chance for some Q&A at the end. And I hope that it will be lively discussion with a lot of Q&A because this whole process challenge us as, at a really fundamental level in terms of how we understand the author of our faith. Now, there are three ways to look at what happens in the first quest. The first one is denigration, the second one is accommodation, and the third one is non-accommodation. Now, how does this work? The first quest really begins with somebody named Hermann Reimarus. All these are Germans, by the way, who get into the mix here. Why it comes out of Germany, I'm not sure, but that's where it started, and the Germans build on each other's thinking. All right. So Reimarus wrote a book, notice 1778. It was written actually 10 years after he died. I mean, it was written before he died. I have to say that right, or he has very unusual talents. All right. So basically, and the reason he did, because if he did not buy into the official interpretation of who Jesus was, according to the church, he would have been fired from his post in university. And this was consistently true. And there were a number of Jesus scholars in those days who were fired because they did not accept all that was said about the nature of Jesus, especially as we say it in the kerygma, conceived by the Holy Spirit, born of the Virgin Mary. From a modern scientific standpoint, that seems not to be credible or even possible, just as some of the miracles of the Bible. So how do we reconcile it? To say they weren't true is to immediately put yourself on the outs, so to speak, with those who were politically in charge and could affect your career. So Reimarus was the first, and he said, and he, if you ever heard somebody say, there are some people out there who think that the disciples stole Jesus' body from the tomb, right? There's your culprit. There's your scholar who started it out. He had a very strong dislike for the church, largely because he considered it arrogant. And he also considered once the church got in power, it tried to impose its position or its interpretation on non-believers. And if they resisted, they frequently ended up in harm's way. And the church history, as we know, is unfortunately filled with that kind of disagreement and punishment of those who didn't accept official political line with regard to a theological interpretation of who he was. And so Reimarus had a hard time with that. He also looked to Jesus, and this is I've discovered in my discussions about the historical Jesus, this is the most difficult aspect of the study of the historical Jesus for traditional Christians to accept, and that is Jesus was wrong. Oh, how could the author of the faith be wrong? What does that mean? That's a direct to the heart of the faith, commitment of the faith. Jesus was wrong. Well, what does this mean? Well, Reimarus took seriously, I'll move ahead, that Jesus in his own time believed that the kingdom of God would come while that generation was still alive, that he would be the king of the new kingdom, and his 12 disciples would be the heads of reconstituted tribes. Okay, guess what? That didn't happen. That's what Romero says. If we're going to take Jesus seriously and study him historically, at some point we have to acknowledge that in terms of his perception of what he thought was going to happen, that is his self-consciousness of his times and his role in it, might have been wrong. That's hard for many, many Christians to accept. But that does not necessarily mean that he left the church without anything that it could build on and apply to the development of the Bible and the creeds and the church's deep faith in who he was. We're going to try to connect the two. But Ramirez, in particular, was one of the first ones to say he was wrong. And this definitely would have caused him to get fired from his position at the university, all right? Which was closely allied, by the way, with the church and the political structure. All right, now this is the accommodation phase. After Ramirez comes along and says, okay, let's see how we can continue to work constructively with the Bible and the creeds. The first one was Erhard Paulus. And what's important to remember is that these are people who are trying to not reject the Bible or the creeds, but to accommodate them to the modern world. So Paulus says, oh, well, this is not hard to understand. Modern psychology tells us that much can be explained in terms of the way in which the mind looks at something. So the miracles and so on, and the faith healings, can be explained psychologically, is the way to think of it. That is, people had visions, they thought things were happening, and they might not necessarily in a historical sense, but that doesn't mean that they aren't significant. They are still significant because we can explain them. They're psychosomatic, the way to think of it. Some of the healings that Jesus did, people believe they were healed and cured. Not a problem. Modern science can handle that. There's no contradiction here. Some people actually call it a psychoceramic. But what does that mean? That means crackpot. That's what it means, psychoceramic. And some people say, well, the church was a little psychoceramic in explaining the psychosomatic conditions that exist when Jesus was a healer. It is very clear. One of the reputations of Jesus is that he was a healer, without a doubt. He could perform miracles, except in his hometown. Remember that passage where a prophet is not honored in his home or her hometown, but everywhere else is the way it works. Is this the son of Joseph? Who is this? We know this guy from the time he was a little kid. He can't possibly be the Messiah. So the further you got away from where he grew up, the more credibility he had in terms of what he was able to do. That comes through clearly in the Bible itself. The next one is David Strauss. David Strauss is very important because David Strauss says, okay, not a problem, we don't have a problem here, but the biblical myths help explain Jesus' power, even though they might not be literally true. For example, to heal somebody, even if it's psychological, means that he had an enormous influence over people, and that they thought that he could bring to them a healing power. One of my favorite stories of the New Testament is the woman who touches his robe in the belief that just by touching his robe, what would happen? She would be cured of whatever ailment she had. That's powerful stuff. Strauss didn't care whether it was true. He said, maybe it's true, we don't know, we can't go back. We didn't have a VCR in those days. We couldn't, no cameras, no iPhones, you know, where we could take movies and so on. But what that story tells us is the enormous power that this person had. And then Ernst Renan came along and said, yeah, that's really not what's important in the Bible anyway, those stories. What's important is Jesus' personality, the power of that personality. And anybody who turns to the New Testament and reads the Gospels will sense the power of that individual, no matter what different people said about him and remembered about him, even though it wasn't written down in 30 to 60 years later. That personality keeps breaking through again and again, and we even are attracted to him that way. There's something in him that really was unique. That is clear. Very clear historically, or he wouldn't have made the response he did. By the way, there were other messiahs at Jesus' time. There were four, really. To call somebody a messiah was a very big deal. Because to call somebody a Messiah means you were anointed in the tradition of King David. And if you were called a Messiah, that meant that God or Yahweh was about to establish you on the throne that was established by King David. And in 1 Samuel says, there will always be somebody on the throne of Israel in the tradition of King David. Therefore, to call Jesus a Messiah was very important. But Jesus' followers are the only ones who said he was resurrected. The followers of all the other messiahs did not make that claim about the person whom they considered the Messiah. And all the other messiah movements disappeared after the death of the founder. It's only in Jesus that we find proclamations of his resurrection, and that becomes, in fact, the cornerstone of the church. It becomes the doctrine of atonement, which I'll talk about later as well. That proclamation, now, the goal is not to debate it, because nobody can go back and, hey, it's not scientifically true, but it's possible under science. That's not the point. The point is, it was the proclamation of the resurrection that transformed people's lives. And when we talked about world religions before, we defined religion in terms of responses, in terms of how is it human transformation in response to perceived ultimacy, some of formal definition. But it means if people believe Jesus was resurrected, they're going to act as if he were. And his followers did. And once Paul was converted and believed that he had experienced Jesus on the Damascus Road and that Jesus had come to him personally, and then he says, and I know of others who've made the same claim, that's powerful. And the motion, the movement of Christianity is built around that initial proclamation. And I suspect that without it, the church probably would cease to exist as we understand the church. That is the cornerstone concept. And that proclamation has been there from the beginning, and it's one of the oldest traditions in the church. It goes way back. There are others that are much younger. But that one is the core. The other one is the Lord's Supper, as we understand it through the Synoptic Gospels. This is my body, this is my blood, and so on. Those two traditions are really the oldest traditions that go back very, very far into the past and are connected with the life of Jesus and the post-death resurrection testimonies that come from his followers. That's the way to think of it. Renan, he says, is that personality. Now, here we go to non-accommodation. So all intents and purposes, we don't have to worry about accommodating Jesus in the modern world. Albert Schweitzer comes along and he says he was very much against the non-accommodations, the accommodationists, and he became a non-accommodationist. He says we have to look at the text and we have to see what Jesus said about himself and his times. And we have to base our understanding of him not by dismissing that, but by building our understanding of him out of the Bible. Not in place of the Bible in the sense of accommodation. We have to start with who he was, or especially what he thought of himself. Now, here's what Schweitzer started out one of the great biblical scholars. He also, as you know, was a missionary. He also played a great organ. After his study of Jesus, he didn't quite know what to do anymore, so I think he went and became a missionary in order to follow the teachings of Jesus, even though he had struggled with identifying who the real historical Jesus was. And he believes, he went actually through two phrases. One, he believed that the Son of Man would come down from clouds and establish the new kingdom, and Jesus would be the king. The second interpretation is that Jesus believed he had to suffer in order to trigger the coming of the Son of Man and the transformation of the new kingdom. I'll talk about that in a little bit later. But Schweitzer finally said, gosh, if he was an apocalyptic in his own times, he was wrong. The world didn't suddenly come dramatically to an end. It went on. That was the first thing. Jesus thought his suffering would trigger the apocalyptic action of God. Guess what? He was wrong again. And alas, the third one is that Jesus believed he would be the new king and his disciples would rule. He was wrong a third time. One has to respect Schweitzer's tremendous honesty. What happened to him is he ceased believing in the divinity of Christ, but he fully accepted his humanity. And what impressed Schweitzer so much about Jesus is Schweitzer's perception that as he was so obedient to God, that he could live a life of full obedience in a way that very few of us can, and possibly nobody can. So he had this enormous respect for Jesus. He became a kind of a Jesus mystic, if you will. A Unitarian Jesus mystic is the best way to think of it. He ceased being a Trinitarian, but his affection, his allegiance to Jesus remained lifelong, even though he had a struggle with his divinity, with Jesus' divinity. But what he liked about his humanity is that Jesus was able to identify with all of us. And if he could do it, guess what? We can potentially do it. We can potentially get that close to God. We can potentially deepen our faith. We can potentially become more loving and loving human beings. That was Schweitzer's position, is that it was his humanity that impressed him the most, not necessarily the divinity aspects of the kerygma. So what happens is that, in some sense, Schweitzer, this is number four up here, it is not possible to reconcile Jesus' apocalyptic worldview with the modern scientific worldview. They are incompatible, and in biblical terms, this means, and this is a very famous Schweitzer phrase, Jesus comes to us as one unknown. Meaning we can't really know who he was. We have some thoughts and words about him, but a lot of what we say about him is an extension of who he was and the impact he had that was made or constructed, that was elaborated by the church as the church grew and expanded and built its testimony around who he was. So after that, it was kind of all over. The whole idea here was Schweitzer's book brought the first quest to an end, and scholars reasoned that if Jesus' ideas cannot be accommodated to the modern scientific world, why try? It brought the first quest to an end, all right? Now, I've got a couple more minutes here, and then we'll turn it over for discussion. There are two other people that are important, and I bring them up now because we're going to talk about their ideas in the second and the third quest. The second one was William Reed, who wrote a book in 1901 called The Messianic Secret, and it's based upon Mark. And it was Reed's position that the narrative of Mark, which starts with what? Jesus' baptism. Not with his birth, but with his baptism, was what's called ex eventu. That is, it was reconstructed 30 years after Jesus' life when the theology of the church had already begun to develop. And that the story of Jesus as presented in Mark is really a reconstruction of remembered events based upon a theological interpretation that starts with the baptism of Jesus. In other words, it's very important, the narrative in Mark, says Reedy, is fictional. Doesn't mean the events aren't true, but the way they're laid out and the theological interpretation is an invention of the church. And in this particular case, Mark. Mark's gospel, most people think, was written in Rome during the time of the persecutions by Nero. And this is kind of a pep talk gospel. Stay in there. Hang in there with Jesus. And just as he was resurrected, if you hang in there with him to death in his name and follow in his cross, his image, guess what will happen to you after you pass away? You too will be resurrected with him. That was it. Now, this isn't yet the Jesus who dies for the sins of the world. That comes later. But this is the Jesus whom followers perceived that if they were obedient to him unto death, they would follow in the same resurrection tradition that he personally experienced. So that's where that comes from. Now, does that mean the resurrection didn't occur? The answer is, that's not the issue. The issue is that his followers, even before Mark was written, proclaimed that he had. And the Gospel of Mark, which is the first of the four Gospels in our Bible, professes that. And it starts with his baptism. And even as he's walking down to Jerusalem in what some think was a one-year rather than a three-year ministry, which is John, the Gospel of John, he tells his disciples, I must go to Jerusalem to be crucified so that I can be resurrected. He tells them that on the way down there. And his disciples said, "We don't get it. What are you telling us?" Oh, after it was over, they got it. But they didn't get it until it had actually happened. That's why it's called eventu, after the event. That's when they got it. They figured it out. Now, another scholar, and then I'm going to stop. And this is Rudolf Bultmann. He's a New Testament scholar of, let's say, 30, 40 years ago. And he said, it's all this historical study stuff, it's futile. We'll never find who he is because there's so many different interpretations of him. And besides, to be a Christian, that's not what counts. What really counts is, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and Jesus Christ, that's called the kerygma. So basically, what we discover here, according to Bultmann, it's the kerygma that's important. That's why this class is called what? The kerygma. That's why also we have an Apostles' Creed. Bultmann would love it. He would love it. In fact, he's smiling right now wherever he happens to be, even though he died in 1976. He said, right on, that is correct. Search around all you want for the historical Jesus. And even if you find out the facts of his life, it doesn't mean you're necessarily going to become a person of faith. To become a person of faith means to accept the kerygma. That was his position. I'm going to stop here and say we've got a number of issues laid out here. Can, right? Can the narrative be trusted? Can it not be trusted? How much is an adaptation to who he was? Can we sort through, like, you know, how do you do that with an artichoke? You know, you peel off the, oh, there it is. It's really good stuff. Same with onions. It's got a lot of layers and you can peel them back. The study of the historical Jesus is peeling back the layers of the onion. And Bultmann says, forget it. You're going to find him. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. Someone will disagree with you, but that's not what counts. Go read the Bible, for goodness sake. Go to church. You will experience him as the charismatic Christ of the church, and that will become the core of your faith, no matter how much you know about the historical Jesus. Well, if that's where it stopped, we wouldn't have three more sessions in here. But we have three more sessions, and we're going to build on what we've done, and I'm going to stop because I want to leave some time for questions. Yes, sir. Well, I don't know if you heard the question, but the question has to do with modernism, postmodernism. When postmodernists define the nature of truth, they generally tend to be relativists. The modernists believe, out of the Enlightenment, said we can know truth, we can discover it. And the postmodernists say even what we call the discoveries or the methods of science are themselves all relative. They are not absolute. So postmodernists, as you're being defining it here, it would say that, yeah, there are different interpretations and ways of looking at Jesus, and so this would be kind of consistent with a postmodernist view, but it doesn't stop there with the Christian church. The Christian church is there are different points of view of who the Jesus was, but some are truer than others. And how do we get to them? So Bultmann would say, you can't, because there are too darn many views. But what we do have is the kerygma, which is the heart of the church. It's the core of our faith. And that's what we need to stay with. Can we prove it to be true? Bultmann would say, why are you even asking that question? We can't prove it. We know that. Just go talk to a few Jesus scholars and you'll end up, you'll talk to three Jesus. You know the old saying, where two or three are gathered in my name, there will be two or three denominations. Have you ever heard that? This is like where two or three Jesus scholars are gathered, there will be three different interpretations of who Jesus was. And Bultmann said, that's the nature of it. That's not what counts. And if all these conflicts exist among the Jesus scholars themselves, here I am, Mr. Joe in the pew of the church. What am I going to think? Bultmann says, I got your answer. I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and Jesus. That's the faith. That's the core of the faith. Then the only other question is, how does Jesus relate to that? And that's what historical Jesus studies is about. Yes, sir. Could I go to one final comment. Exactly right. There are some truths beyond science, including science is a truth beyond science, because science is a methodology that one has to accept, and that may not be true either. For example, I'll give you an example. I always have this discussion with my students in class. And I ask them, are you here and are you a real person? Are you here? And they say, well, that's kind of a dumb question. Of course I'm here. And I ask them, have you ever had a dream that you thought was real and you woke up and you discovered it wasn't a dream, wasn't real, it was a dream? Well, how do you know you're not in a dream right now? Better yet, how do you know you're not in a nightmare? I mean, it's even better. You cannot even prove that you have a physical presence in the universe and that the way in which we define the laws of nature are necessarily constant. And we know that our understanding, and Wallace addressed this so many times, that our understanding of nature is constantly changing. What we know today, now there's a lot of discussion on dark matter and dark energy. There's multiple universes and all this sort of stuff that's going on. If any of these comes through, what we understand about the nature of the physical universe and how we derive our knowledge of it will change. That's consistent with the discovery or the search for the historical Jesus, is that what we can say today may change tomorrow. But we still have at the core of the church the kerygma, which is the impact that Jesus had on his followers, which includes us as a continuation of that movement. Great question. I'm going to go male, female, male, female. Yes, ma'am.
You know, I believe all these historians, you know, come in with their own idea of what the history of Jesus is, and all they're going to try to do is try to prove it. Okay? They're not going to try to really find out what it is, but try to prove their idea.
Yeah, that's why it's called autobiography rather than biography. And they're the Jesus scholars who will acknowledge that. My view of Jesus is really what I want him to be. And I will accept some data as factual and other data as not useful. You're actually right. And that was Bultmann's big problem. He says, we find in Jesus what we want to see in him. And even the search for the historical Jesus will leave us in different positions. To the extent that we do impose on our understanding of Jesus as much out of our own personalities as we discover factually what's really there. That's correct. That's a very good comment. Very good. Okay, male, female, male, 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 and then you're next, okay?
On the statements that some of these guys made that Jesus was wrong, it seems to me there's a distinction, and I'm wondering how much they discussed it, okay, between what Jesus said, hearers understood, okay, and what Jesus believed.
I'm going to discuss that. I'm going to discuss that in sessions 2, 3, and 4. That's exactly the question. That's exactly the question. But I can't answer it now because I want you to come back next week. Just kidding. But that's the right question. How much did he think about himself? What did others think about him? And how did the two connect? And did what he said he thought was going to come true come to pass? And did others perceive him that way or differently and use his words in a different way?
I was thinking also the distinction. Jesus may have believed and seen one thing, but said another.
That's correct. He may have believed one thing and yet left a different impact on his followers that was different from what he might have said. That is correct, and that's the direction we're actually going to go in. But at the same time, we will discover that much of what he thought of himself was appropriated by the church. A lot of people think that the church created a Jesus image. The new research suggests that the church is an extension of Jesus' image of himself. That's the new research. But we've got to go through that process before we get to that point. All right. Now, think of it that way. Is the church's view of Jesus all made up? Or is the church's view of Jesus an extension of who Jesus really was? And if it's an extension, then it's an adaptation to him and not an invention to what? To just create a church and satisfy its followers. That's the real issue. That's the real issue. I've got one question left right here.
thing that convinced me, and I've read this several times, is that each of his disciples died a martyr's death.
That is correct. All of the original 12, we think did. We think. There's not evidence of all of them did. And we know that one died a suicide. That was Judas. We know that. And I'll talk about Judas' role. It's a very interesting role in the history of Jesus because a lot of different interpretations of who he was. But I'll get into that in session 4, actually. No, session 3. I'll talk about that in session 3. Walt, one more question. How do you want to do it? One more? Who wants to ask? We've had anybody? Yes. I recommend reading them all. I do. I recommend reading them all. Don't be afraid of this literature. It scares a lot of people. Now, here's the difference. The difference among many people is that I just take the Bible literally, whatever it says, and I accept it. That's a very fundamentalist, kind of literalist, inerrancy point of view. Another point of view is I take it seriously. And I'm going to find the real Jesus somewhere in there that is compatible with and consistent with the charismatic faith of the church. I take it very seriously. Now, let me just make one final comment and then we'll call it quits. And that is this. Next week, we'll talk about a group of people who are called the minimalists or reductionists. They are the ones who strip it all down to find the real truth of who Jesus was. They're called minimalists. They're very credible. And they're some of the best Jesus scholars are minimalists. The third and the fourth weeks are going to be what I would call adaptationalists or extension or people who try to take the pieces of the Bible and make the most coherent sense and picture of Jesus they can out of those various pieces. Next week, the group of scholars called the reductionists begin with a lot of suspicion about whether or not you can trust the text of the Bible. They say, if it's all fictional, I have to be careful. I don't necessarily trust it, nor do I trust that Jesus was an apocalyptic prophet. We think this stuff is made up, so we want to get down to the core sayings of who he really was. That's called reductionism. The third quest says, we don't accept that procedure or that method. What we have in front of us is a text that's made up of various pieces and traditions that were put together by four gospel writers in specific contexts to spread the faith. How, when we look at all those pieces, do they make the greatest amount of sense in terms of who Jesus was as a historical figure and how the church adapted itself to him rather than made him up in the sense of the Jesus or the Christ of faith they wanted, because that's what they wanted to do. That, in other words, you have two points of view, reductionism versus, one is the Humpty Dumpty. The third and fourth weeks, we're going to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. The second week, which is next week, Humpty Dumpty shatters. That's the way to think of it. And the wave right now is to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And I'm going to identify those scholars who do that at a very high level of credibility. That, in the end, deepens our faith. Not only historically, but factually as well. Thank you, Walt.
Thank you.